And here we are. It's just 12 o'clock. Boing. And you are listening to CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM. And it is time now for the Animal Voices Show. So hold on to your hats. Here they come.
Yes, and welcome to Animal Voices once again. Saving just one animal won't change the world, but surely the world will change for that one animal. In this program, we present a radio program that delivers a message that inspires people to improve the lives of all animals. You're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. Also known as Co-op Radio, your community-based and community-sponsored radio station. Alan Jensen is our technician and co-host. Thank you, Alan. My name is Carl Loskin, and regular co-host Marge Adams is not with us today. Most of our program today will be an interview with Howard Lyman, a fourth-generation family farmer, cattle rancher from Montana. He is the author of best-selling books, No More Bull and Mad Cowboy, and he tells his story about the agricultural industry and the changes that have taken place in his DVD, Mad Cowboy, which has recently been released. So, Alan, in the news this week, we came across a wonderful editorial by Pete McMartin in the Vancouver Sun. And it's of special interest, I think, to all people in Vancouver because it affects the millions of migrating birds. And you've been at the forefront of watching this because you're so interested in birds. So Gordon Campbell's Gateway Project and port expansion may in fact be in jeopardy as a result of this wonderful bird.
Indeed. Pete McMartin's article was specifically around the western sandpiper, which was one of the species of shorebirds that passes through Vancouver in the spring and in the fall. And they stop around Boundary Bay, just south of Vancouver, to feed on the way. There are huge mud flats down there, and it's quite striking when you go there at low tide and you see just how vast these mud flats are. They just seem to stretch for, you know, forever south of Boundary Bay. And because of the biofilm that forms on top of these mud flats, as well as the creatures that live in the mud, there's huge amounts of food. And so these shorebirds, and millions of them, literally millions of them, stop here to stock up on food, to fatten up, before they fly the rest of the way on their migratory trip from South America to the Canada's Arctic, to the tundra and the Arctic. They breed in the tundra and they spend their winters, they go south where it's warm, in South America, which is an incredibly, these are very small birds and they fly incredible distances. And so Pete McMartin's article was specifically around the western sandpiper, which is the bird that probably comes in the largest numbers. But it's worth pointing out that there are a number of other species of shorebirds that come and avail themselves of all the food at Boundary Bay in the spring, particularly in the spring. There's at least a dozen other species of shorebirds that stop here. Some of them in large numbers. Like if you go down there much of the year, you can see dunlin down there, thousands and thousands of dunlin flying around. Then these are very small sandpipers flying in clouds. It's so great to watch them and the other small sandpipers when they fly in large numbers, because when they move from place to place, they just rise together in a big sort of cloud, amorphous cloud-like shape, and move around Boundary Bay. And you can stand on the shore there and watch these giant flocks of thousands of birds just kind of floating around and going in these different abstract shapes as they move from place to place. Anyway, So Pete McMartin's article was specifically around the proposed development or further development at Roberts Bank terminal down there, so they can extend the Roberts Bank jetty and get a lot more freighters coming in to take more containers and coal from that particular port. Of course, it was originally built as a coal port, but it's evolved into a major container port down there as well. And so part of the long-term plan of the provincial Liberals is to make Canada a super port on the Pacific. And they've chosen this location to be the major place where they would have their super port. The problem is that nobody knows exactly how it's going to interfere with the local environment, particularly along the shoreline and particularly along the mudflats, because it will affect the currents. This rich mudflat forms because of the water coming out of the Fraser River, which circulates down and around and forms these mudflats. And there's a lot of nutrients around there in the water, and there's this continuing supply of silt coming to form the mud. And this creates an environment where vast numbers of small invertebrate animals, as well as this biofilm that forms on the top, ends up as the food for all these birds that migrate through here. And some of the birds are here much of the year, and some of them only come for a couple of days on their way north. But the important thing is that this is an area of global importance. This isn't just a locally important thing. Like, a significant percentage of the world's population of these sandpipers comes here. Like, when you're talking millions of birds, you're talking about a significant amount of the population. And these birds are definitely under threat because at other parts, so like they fly from here all the way up to the Arctic, to the tundra, and then they go down to South America in the winter, and in other areas their environment's being threatened also, so it's an ongoing problem.
So now what's happened is that these birds in 1991, when the biologist Elner did a study, there was some... there were some 9 million birds, and so now, that ranged between 3 and 4 million birds, a million birds, imagine, down at Roberts Bank there at the...
it's quite a sight, too.
And apparently, at this stage now, the numbers have been reduced to a half. So Pete McMartin also mentioned in his article here that these birds fly some 14,500 kilometers. It's absolutely astronomical. So magical little animals.
It's quite astounding. Like I said, they're so small, these birds. They only weigh about an ounce. I mean, they're really, really small. and so the amount of food that they take is critical. And so when they stop for somewhere to get some food, it's absolutely critical they get the food, or they won't have the energy to continue on in their flight, which is why it's so important that this key spot, like the Fraser Delta here in Boundary Bay, is one of the key places in the whole of the west part of North and South America for migratory birds. We haven't even talked about the ducks. There's vast numbers of ducks that come up here, too, and into Boundary Bay. But, yes, we have Howard Lyman on the line now. So, Carl, maybe you want to introduce Howard, and maybe towards the end of the show, if we have time, we can talk a little bit more about the threat to the shorebirds in Vancouver.
Yes, and it's a threat because of rampant overdevelopment and the trade with China and Southeast Asia that is going to... quadruple the size of the Delta port. Well, Howard Lyman has been a long-time friend of EarthSafe Canada. He is a fourth-generation family farmer, cattle rancher from Montana, now living in Ellensburg, Washington. He is the author of best-selling books like No More Bull and Mad Cowboy, and he tells his story in the DVD Mad Cowboy and the recently released DVD Mad Cowboy Lecture. He speaks from a background of personal experience. It is the plain truth from the cattle rancher who won't eat meat. Welcome to Animal Voices, Howard Lyman.
Oh, it's a joy to be with you again, Carl.
Well, you know, you have had generations of experiences as a cattle rancher and observing the changes in the whole agricultural industry. And it seems that people are suddenly waking up to these dramatic changes. Maybe you can just give us a little perspective from how you see it.
Well, I would say that if we stop and look at it the way we're producing food in North America today, it is absolutely, totally non-sustainable. We have lost 75% of all the topsoil that was in North America when the boat people first arrived, and we realize that it takes 500 years for nature to produce an inch of topsoil. We've lost 75% of what was here a mere 300-400 years ago. Having produced an inch, lost three quarters of what's there. If you look at an inventory of North America, you will see never in history have we ever had less natural resources than what we have today. At the same time, we have quadrupled the number of people in North America. Now, ask yourself, is there a future for our children and grandchildren? If we continue to go on this path, we're going towards the cliff at 200 miles an hour. The politicians and the bureaucrats are assuring everybody not to worry, that they'll give everybody the best care possible that survives at the bottom of the cliff. I don't think it's time for us to go over the cliff. I think it's time for us to change the road. And when we stop and take a look at those things that can be done, and, you know, we're not asking every individual out there to do everything. We're just asking every individual to do everything that they can do. And if we don't do that, Carl, I don't think there's a future for our children and grandchildren.
Now, before we go on to what can be done, maybe you can just give us an outline of what has contributed towards this topsoil destruction.
Well, I think that the biggest problem has been the way that we have farmed in North America. Let me give you an example. In Iowa, in 1850, they built a church. At the time they built the church, all of the land around the church was farmed. All of it was at the same elevation. That church has been in continual use from 1850 till today. They just had a picture of it up on the wall of when it was built in 1850, and they just took a recent picture and put it up against the wall, and lo and behold, the church was 10 feet higher than all of the ground around it that was still being farmed. Our farming methods for the last several hundred years have been absolutely destructive. We have an area off the Gulf of Mexico, off of New Orleans, that is called the dead zone, that's absolutely larger than the state of Massachusetts. Herbicides, pesticides, topsoil that is washed off of the central part of the United States. We cannot continue to go doing what we've done in the past. It's time for us to wake up to the fact that there are better methods to achieve what we're after than what we're doing right now. And every individual out there listening today should realize that every time you reach into your pocket, every time you spend a dollar, you're voting on the future. What kind of a future do you want?
Now, fertilizers, were when they were first starting to produce them in enormous quantities, artificial fertilizers, has that contributed towards this topsoil loss?
Well, of course it is. You know, we got this idea, and I'm just as much to blame as anybody else out there. I was in Montana. I went to Montana State University. I learned a thing that was called better living through chemistry. We didn't have to worry about farming in conjunction with Mother Nature. We could provide all of the inputs that were out there. Artificial fertilizer, you know, nature's fertilizer is compost. It is the breaking down of plant material that refurbishes the nutrients in the soil. But we had the idea that all we had to do was go take some natural gas, turn it into nitrogen, put the nitrogen in. You know, we could We could grow a crop in the Sahara Desert if we had enough chemicals and enough water. And we forgot all about dealing with Mother Nature. But the problem is, when we do not deal with Mother Nature, we lose things. Remember when they had the big dust bowl in the central part of the U.S.? The winds picked up the soil and blotted out the sun for days at a time. We lost billions and billions of tons of topsoil, and all of that was because we were farming ground that was so fragile that it should have never been farmed. We were using farming techniques and things like artificial fertilizer that would not stand up to the wind. So, you know, when we look at it, was fertilizer a part of it? Absolutely. The tools we were using, they were part of it. The mindset we had, that was part of it.
Now, the cattle ranching industry, which you, of course, you're very familiar with, having been a cattle rancher in Montana, contributed towards this topsoil destruction, would you say? I mean, they have incursions into or rights over crown land or state land or federal land. Maybe you can give us a picture there.
Well, you know, I happen to live here in Ellensburg, Washington. I just picked up a book and read it about the first cattlemen that came here 1850. They were talking about blue bunch wheatgrass that was belly deep to the cows. I don't know what blue bunch wheatgrass looks like, but the fact of it is there's none left around here because they absolutely grazed it into the ground. It would not stand up against natural or overgrazing. And here it was the climax vegetation, the best plant available for this area, and today there is none of it. We've actually destroyed the environment for that crop, which was the best for this area. And you know what we replaced it with? Cheatgrass and sagebrush. You know, has almost no value as far as grazing anymore. We've just destroyed what at one time was the most the closest thing you could have to the Garden of Eden.
Now, in the recent years, the whole cost structure of producing food has been in the limelight as, you know, people in the Southeast Asia and many countries aren't able to, struggling to purchase the basic requirements for what they need to live. And that's a fairly new development that people are now becoming aware of. How do you see this whole price inflation and thing evolving now? And, of course, the peak oil issue is big, too.
Well, we're going to see probably the most dramatic events that have ever happened in human history that are going to unfold in our lifetime right now. Just stop and think about it. We're raising cattle. And the cattle ranchers are beating their chest and saying, you know, I'm out there doing for this cow and calf as nature intended. But the only thing is, they're the suppliers for the factory feedlots. And the factory feedlots, we're putting them in there. We're taking 16 pounds of grain to put 1 pound of meat on your plate. 16 pounds of grain would feed 32 people. We have millions and millions of hungry people around the world. And all of a sudden, we get into this $100 and $35 a barrel oil. And so now we have the pressure of, do we take this grain, which 80% of the grain in North America today is being stuffed down the throat of an animal, are we going to take this and continue to feed it to cattle? Or are we going to take it and make it into $4 or $5 a gallon fuel? But at the same time, we still have the millions and millions of people around the world that are going hungry. We, down here in the United States right now, were involved in a war in the Middle East. I think if you look at it, you will say that this was not about democracy. This was all about oil. And if we're going to end up fighting the world for oil, We're going to end up making large portions of the world hungry. I think that we in the United States are in for some very, very tough times in the future if we do not get our priorities in order. When we worry more about our taste buds than we worry about hungry people, I think that's a very poor legacy that we have for the future.
Now, when you're talking about our taste buds, the statistics show that the average U.S. person consumes 120 kilograms of meat per person per year. And so is this an equation which you see needs to be changed?
Oh, absolutely. Stop and look at it. Right now in North America, one out of every two people dying are dying of heart disease. Main contributing factors, saturated fat and cholesterol. All cholesterol comes from animal products, 100%. The majority of saturated fat in our diet come from animal products. One out of every three people in North America have cancer. One out of four are dying of cancer. And that number is going up to the point where heart disease is coming down and people dying of cancer is going up because people are dying younger of cancer. They can't even get old enough to have a heart attack anymore. We're seeing diabetes grow astronomically. Six out of every 10 people in North America today are either overweight or obese. Carl, the health of North America is getting worse and worse and worse. And if you read Dr. T. Colin Campbell's book, The China Study, you will see without doubt that heart disease, cancer, diabetes, obesity, every one of them, one of the direct factors of those illnesses happens to be animal flesh. So what we're going to have to do, we're either going to have to decide, are we going to continue to cater to our taste buds, our addictions to animal fat, or are we going to look at it and say it's about time that we start eating the food that our bodies were designed for? Our bodies, stop, look at them. Our teeth, exactly the same chemical composition as a cow. No doubt a cow is an herbivore, unless we turn them into carnivores or cannibals. We end up with digestive juices in our mouth that are meant to break down plants and not animals. An animal-based diet is a very acidic diet. But humans operate best on an alkaline diet, one that is basic in nature. So our digestive juices are to break down plants, not animals. Our digestive system, 5 to 7 times longer than true carnivores. A true carnivore, the idea is to get the meat in, break it down, and get it out. With our long digestive system, we eat meat, it's in there, it rots, it putrefies, and we're seeing colorectal cancer growing astronomically. So it's clear, if you look at the evidence that is out there, whether you're looking at the way our bodies are designed, whether you look at studies like Dr. T. Colin Campbell's, whether you look at the future of what's happening with heart disease, cancer, diabetes, obesity, the fact of it is most people in North America today are eating the incorrect diet and they're paying the price with a shorter lifespan.
Now, Howard Lyman, you're known as the cattle rancher who won't eat meat, and you explain it so beautifully. I was just looking at these statistics of the average meat consumption in the United States, which was 120 kilograms per person per year. That's 240 pounds of meat average for each citizen a year. That's 20 pounds a month. They're eating 20 pounds of meat every month. I mean, my God, there's only 32 days in there and they're eating 20 pounds. I mean, it's staggering.
Well, of course it is. And Carl, you know, look at it, that we've made it so very easy for people You know, you go into the grocery store and you go to the meat counter and everything's in this nice little plastic container. You have no idea that it was really a living animal at one time. It's all trimmed, you know, and they have the most of the fat cut off. Well, do you realize that if you go to the hamburger that's there, a hamburger is about 40% fat? If we go to a fast food restaurant and we get a 4-ounce burger, take it to a DNA lab, and we will find there are between 500 and 1,000 different animals in one 4-ounce burger. Not much to worry about unless you look at something like mad cow disease, which Canada just had another recent case of mad cow disease, one that sort of made the idea that the feed ban in Canada was working, because this animal had to be infected after the feed ban went into place. But let's say that one of these animals gets into the food supply. It takes the about amount of material to cover a sharp end of a pin to cause the infection in a human that will incubate anywhere from 10 to 60 years. We have a 4-ounce burger. There are 500 to 1,000 different animals in there. Do you feel comfortable that all of those 500 or 1,000 animals were free of mad cow disease? These are things, Carl, that really concern me. They make me think. There was just a study that came out of England that they found, you know, they thought they had isolated the gene that was most susceptible to variant CJD. Now they found another gene in the human genome that is also susceptible, and now that's a concern in England, because instead of the infectious in the animal and the human being from 10 to 40 years, now with this new gene they find that's susceptible to it, it increases the incubation time up to 60 years. And we're talking about something that is 100% fatal. You know, what's coming out is not good news for us and our families.
Now, we're led to believe by the BC Cattle Growers Association that this is all safe and the export should continue to Indonesia and other countries. But the whole issue that you had with Winfrey Oprah was that they're still feeding animals to cows. I mean, and they still consider it to be safe. How are they still feeding animals to cows?
Well, it's the craziest thing in the world. Most educated countries in the world have banned the feeding of animals to animals. But we're still feeding cows to pigs, chickens, turkeys, and horses. We're feeding pigs, chickens, turkeys, and horses back to cows. We're actually going out and collecting roadkill, deer, elk, possum, raccoons, grinding them up and feeding them to cows. Euthanized dogs and cats are being ground up and they're being fed to cows. Well, we know in the laboratory that you can take a spongiform disease from a cow and transfer it to another animal, say a dog or a pig or a chicken, or you can take a pig or a chicken with a spongiform disease and transfer it back to cows. So the idea that we have put in this great safety of not feeding cows to cows, as long as we continue to feed animals back to cows, and as long as we continue to feed cows to other animals, we are still amplifying the spongiform disease in the animal herd. You know, I was just saying that we're collecting roadkill, deer and elk. They have a spongiform disease that is called a chronic wasting disease. It is more virulent than any other form that we know of. That a deer can transfer this disease from one to another by touching noses, licking a common salt block. And here we are, we're taking roadkill. Thousands and thousands of these animals are going to rendering plants after they're hit by cars, ground up, turned into feed, and we're feeding those back to cows. sometimes I think that we are absolutely insane.
Now, as you said, one hamburger can come from approximately 500 to 1,000 cows, which is puts another light on, what's being served at so many fast food restaurants. But that's staggering. But why? You say that the gestation period till this comes out can be some 60 years with the this brain-wasting disease, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. But one doesn't hear much about it. The industry has sort of muzzled the press, or how do you view that?
Well, I think if you look at what happened to Oprah and myself, where the cattleman went out and spent an untold amount of money to sue us, spent him in court for 6 years, they were sending a message out to the media. You know, don't report on our problems, or we'll go and spend millions of dollars dragging you through court. You know, look at the fact. I went on the Oprah show, and I said we were feeding cows to cows. Absolute truth. No one was complaining at that time that that was not true. Oprah said, that just stops me cold. I'll never again eat another burger. Now, she didn't say to the millions of listeners, you shouldn't eat a burger. She said, that stops me cold. I will never again eat a burger. We talk about patting ourselves on the chest and talking about the right of free speech. But the cattleman came out, spent lots of money, drug us through court for 6 years. It was not because we told a lie. It was not because we were recommending to other people what they do. What they were saying is, if you talk about the problems of our industry, we will spend whatever is necessary to show you it is not in your best interest. And so what happened? We have less and less information in the press to the American people. Here's an interesting thing. 3 weeks ago, a young lady, 22 years old, died in Portsmouth, Virginia. They did an autopsy. They found she had variant CJD, which meant that it came from an animal. Now, they were saying very little coverage in the press, but what they did say is that they believe that she got the disease from a surgical instrument for a gastro bypass surgery. Well, even if that was the case, if she got it from a surgical instrument, saying that it was variant CJD, that it came from an animal, it meant that somebody got it from an animal, passed it on to the surgical instrument, and here was this gal, 22 years old, and she dies from it. Did it make national news? Did you see it on the front page of the New York Times? Absolutely not, because they're looking at it now and just saying, well, it's safer to write a story about the presidential election than it is to go and talk to people about the problems with the food supply. And so we have people out there willy-nilly eating these 4-ounce burgers. They probably get a double, seeing as how that the price is being so subsidized by your government and ours that people can get it far below the cost of production. I think we may be incubating millions and millions of cases of spongiform diseases in the people in North America.
What time span do you envisage here? Because how long does it take for this mad cow disease in humans, as you called it, variant CJD, to manifest itself, like in this case with this girl in Virginia that you just mentioned?
Well, what it is the first thing we need to understand is there's probably 1,000 different varieties of CJD. When we started feeding animals to animals, we started mixing the CJD from pigs with chickens and turkeys and horses, and all of a sudden, and we have this witch's brew out there that there may be 1,000 different varieties. We do know that the youngest person that we know of. Probably the incubation time was less than 10 years. But we also know of people that the incubation time has been as much as 40 years. So I think that with this new revelation that they have of the DNA in humans being susceptible to spongiform diseases, and it may move the incubation period up to 60 years, we don't know. But look at the number of people in North America, Carl, that are being diagnosed with Alzheimer's. In the U.S., it's almost 5 million right now. Two studies that are out there that show us that of the people diagnosed with Alzheimer's, somewhere between 5.5% and 13% of them really did not have Alzheimer's. They had CJD. Now, if we look at those numbers being accurate, look at it against the number that are being diagnosed, that means that we have about 450,000 to 500,000 people in the U.S. that really don't have Alzheimer's, that really have the human form of mad cow disease, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. They are talking about the fact that that number of people in the United States, where today is 5 million, within 40 years they expect that to be somewhere around 50 million. That's a staggering amount of people that may have the spongiform disease in their system that is right now incubating, which will be 100% fatal.
Now, to follow on from that, is that I believe, is this true that when people have passed away from Alzheimer's disease, and you say between 5.5% and 13% of them, in fact, don't have Alzheimer's, they have a form of mad cow disease, that they also not doing a biopsy on these pathology on the people's brains? How could they be so negligent? I just don't understand that.
Well, the first thing is that most people in the medical profession do not want to touch a CJD brain with a 10-foot pole. Remember, they cannot clean up their operating theater. They cannot sterilize their instruments. If we go to England, where they're doing autopsies on people with suspected cases of variant CJD, they never remove the instruments from those theaters. They never use those operating theaters for anything else than doing the pathology on suspected cases of CJD. Here in the United States and also in Canada, the medical profession, they don't want to contaminate their instruments. They're talking about in England of going to disposable instruments because they have so many suspected cases that are over there. So, Carl, what we're looking at right now is just like you've seen the old adage where they have a canvas covering up an elephant with holes cut in it that people stick their hands through and they describe what they're feeling. It depends on where you are on the elephant, what you're feeling. And here we are with these spongiform diseases, same way. We're not going out and getting good data so that we know how many people have it, where it came from. We're just sticking our head in the sand and saying that it is all Alzheimer's. And the studies that are out there that I know of are showing that not to be true.
Now, we're talking with Howard Lyman, who is a great experience. He was a fourth generation cattle rancher farmer from Montana. And Howard, I'm wondering if we could we'd need to do a station ID, if you could stay on for another 15 minutes, because you have so much information to tell us, and maybe we'll talk about the whole industry that you were involved with, the Monsantos, and also the impact of peak oil and your view of that in the next section of Animal Voices. Is that
sure.
Okay with you?
Yep, Fine with me, Carl.
Okay. So we're listening to you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, your community and community-sponsored radio station. Well, it's a great privilege to have Howard Lyman on air today. He has a wonderful web page. It's called madcowboy.com. And if ever you want to be receive a quarterly newsletter, go to madcowboy.com and sign up for up-to-date news, so much up-to-date news that is fascinating and which I believe is absolutely essential because we're living in this changing, rapidly changing world. Well, Howard, thanks for giving us your wonderful your time. The agricultural industry, as you've already painted the picture with so much news that doesn't come out, but we also look at the enormous growth of the companies like Monsanto and ConAgra, that they have a monopoly on in the agricultural industry. And maybe you can just say something about that, because it's also that when we see that the U.S. government and also I believe the Canadian government is promoting ethanol, that they're really giving a gift to the farmers. How does that work?
Well, you have to remember that there's great political power that is being welded now with the fact that there's money from these big corporations that's going into the re-election of political candidates. They're spending millions of dollars in making donations to people in politics. When I worked in Washington, D.C. for 5 years, I learned a thing that was called the Golden Rule. Them that have the gold make the rules. And I can tell you right now from personal experience, the government in the United States of America is the best government that money can buy. what we're seeing, Carl, is we're seeing companies like Monsanto that looked at it and said, what we need to do is genetically engineer crops. When we genetically engineer them, we can patent them. And when we patent them, then the farmer will have to pay us a royalty to use our seeds that are out there, and those seeds will be designed to best utilize the chemicals that we are making. If you look at the farmer in Canada that ended up being an organic farmer, and he was growing organic crops and never purchased any of the genetically engineered seed that was out there, he was drugged through court, absolutely destroyed by the large multinational chemical companies of Monsanto, because there was crops that his neighbors grew. Those seeds blew into his land. He didn't put them there. He didn't want them there, but they ended up in his crop. And when he ended up in the courtroom, the court came down and just basically destroyed that individual for the profitability of a company like Monsanto. When they genetically engineer seeds, they can patent them. And when they patent them, if they are on your land, whether you put them there or not, you, according to the law, owe them the royalties. I think that this is the biggest experiment that has ever been held on the Homo sapiens. We don't know what these genetically engineered crops are going to do when we're eating them. Look at the United States right now. About 87% of all of the soybeans grown in the United States today are genetically engineered. We don't know what's going to happen when you eat those crops. Animals out there, for some way or another, they can tell the difference. Birds will stay away from genetically engineered crops and go eat those that are naturally grown. How did they know? I don't know. Over in Scotland, they ended up with some rats, and they were feeding the rats genetically engineered potatoes. The rats died. When they redid the study, the same thing happened. The researcher, a well-respected researcher, published the data. The multinational companies came down on the government. The government turned around and fired this individual, totally destroyed his career because he told the people exactly what happened in his experiment. We don't know why the rats died from eating genetically engineered potatoes, but we do know that Homo sapiens, the first genetically engineered product that came to market for us, was called L-tryptophan. People had consumed L-tryptophan for years and years, no problem. First time it was genetically engineered, hundreds of people died. Thousands ended up becoming crippled from it. When they went to Japan to inspect it to find out what went wrong, mysteriously a large fire broke out, burned the plant and all of the records. So, Carl, I'm extremely concerned about genetic engineering. I think this is an experiment that is happening on Homo sapiens today. There's been no testing. If the rats died from the genetically engineered potatoes, are they okay for us? Who knows? Nobody's ever tested them, other than we're testing them in the supermarket, but we don't know if somebody's dying from them or not. These are things that really concern me, and my advice to people is know where your food comes from. Down here in the States, the only label that assures us that something was not genetically engineered is if it is certified organic. They're even trying to change that, but that's the only label that we have today that will tell you that that product does not contain genetically engineered material.
Well, you certainly paint a very gloomy picture of our democracy. But let's turn to ethanol and the different forms in which ethanol is being produced. And, there's so much wastage here. Do we really have a shortage of food, or is it what we're doing it with? It takes 4 pounds of corn to make 1 pound of chicken, and the turnaround from we're growing corn for ethanol. Surely this must be the wrong tool, and it's achieving the wrong result. Would you agree?
Well, of course. You know, right now, if we take ethanol, unless the aftermath of the making ethanol, which happens to be certified protein, that from the aftermath of making ethanol, it is not cost efficient. We put more energy into making it than what we're getting out of it. But the political pressure that's there makes it doable today with the subsidies that are coming out of the taxpayers' pockets. But I'm telling you, Carl, we have no comprehension of what is going to happen in the future right now when we have millions and millions of hungry people. And we are doing things like making ethanol out of food-grade protein while we have people going hungry, that when we're seeing the United States, for example, spending $40 to $60 billion a year to import $20 billion worth of oil from the Middle East, these things are going to come down in the products that we are going to buy in the future. We have not even begun to see this high energy cost being reflected in the products that we're buying today. But we will within the next year, and the middle class people of North America are going to be absolutely shocked to death what the costs are going to be in the supermarket, and the cost of what it's going to take to transport a lot of the products that we're buying from China. Can you imagine when we're looking at $135 a barrel oil, what it's going to cost to propel those ships across the ocean for those trinkets that we're importing from China? We're going to see some monumental changes in the thought process of people in North America in the next year or so.
Now, since food production, especially the meat production, is so high in energy, surely that would make the meat producers raise the cost of meat worldwide. And we're already seeing some hog producers changing their ways here in British Columbia, as it's costing more to feed these animals than what they're getting for it. What do you see here in the near future with the factory farming of animals and the production of meat?
Well, I think the easiest way to look at it is that there's been numerous studies that have shown that it takes about a gallon of fuel to put a pound of meat on the meat counter. You know, we can look at it, and here in the U.S. we're getting just right at about $4 a gallon for fuel. Well, if it costs a gallon of fuel to put a pound of meat, then you should see that meat in the meat counter would have to have a basis cost of $4 a pound. But we're not seeing that, and you know why? Is because the taxpayers are ponying up billions and billions of dollars in subsidies that are going to agriculture, but they're not enough. How would you like to be like a trucker today, pulling in to fueling up your truck, and it costs $1,000 to fuel your truck for one day? Or a farmer with a large tractor that's out there that is burning over $1,000 worth of fuel a day. Just think about what we're going to see happen in agriculture when just the fuel cost, not the anything for replacing equipment or labor or anything else, but fuel cost is going to run somewhere between $700 to $1 million on a large operation. So I'm of the opinion, Carl, that we're going to see the biggest changes that we have ever seen in the history of food supplying, and it's going to happen because what is being triggered right now with this insatiable appetite for energy.
Now, we're going to close off on an optimistic note because, you know, Howard Lyman, some 20 years ago, you came to Vancouver and spoke at EarthSave venue, and you said, no animal has to die for me to live. And my big African elephant ears were flapping, and you dramatically changed my life and my outlook on the whole food issues. But to you have a wonderful book in which you have recipes. It's called No More Bull. Maybe you can just tell us some of the wonderful vegan recipes that you have in your book.
Well, you know, we stop at it. Here I am, a fourth-generation farmer, rancher, feedlot operator. Today I'm a 100% vegan. I eat no animal products. I've never had more energy. I've never felt better. My mind has never been clearer. And it was because I changed my diet. I started eating what my body desired. And so I decided I was going to write a book, and I wanted to tell people the difference between good diets and bad. Remember that chips and Twinkies are a vegetarian diet, but it doesn't mean that it's good for you. And so I wrote a book about what we should be eating, and then I got a hold of the best chefs in North America, and I asked them to give me a recipe that I could use that was tasty, that was easy to prepare, and was good for you. There's over 100 of them in that book. We have people like Brianna Grogan, who is probably one of the greatest chefs in North America, living right up now in British Columbia, she gave me some of the best food recipes you could ever have. So I would say to our listeners today, you know, go online, madcowboy.com, order a copy of the book, and take it home. Not only will you find recipes that are good for you, but you'll see your health improving, you will see your waistline slimming down, and you know, you can look an animal in the eye and say to them, you know, you don't have to die for me to live, and we can live on this planet together, and we'll all be better off.
Wow, that's wonderful, Howard. But with all the wonderful influences you've had, and you've been in Washington, D.C., it must be kind of heartwarming for you to see that Oprah, with whom you had an interesting connection, is on a 21-day vegan cleanse. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, I heard about that, and you know, I can remember that when we were in Amarillo, Texas, which is not the end of the world, but it was clearly visible from there, and we ended up with 6 weeks in the courtroom. At that time, they didn't want me to talk to Oprah about my vegan diet because she had enough on her mind. Well, you know, now she's to the point, she's looking at it, and she got more money and she knows what to do with. Now she has to figure out how can she live long enough to spend some of her money. So, you know, 21 days on a vegan diet may be just a good start for her to becoming a hardcore vegan like me, eating nothing with a face, liver, or a mother. Go, Oprah. You're doing well.
And what's more, she's Kathy Freston, who is promoting this vegan diet for that Oprah Winfrey is on. It's also, she claims that it's beneficial to humans, animals, and our environment. And that's what you have so wonderfully brought to our listeners today. Howard, we owe you a great sense of gratitude for all you have done, and you've done it so willingly and lovingly.
Well, I'll tell you, I just have a great group of friends north of the border, and what I'd like to say to them is I'd like to be able to spend a lot more time with you, but if I can come on the radio every now and then, at least we can communicate, and remember that this old cowboy down here, he loves you up there.
Thank you, Howard. Thank you, Howard. Yes, and you're listening. We've been listening to Howard Lyman, and it's his webpage is madcowboy.com. He sends out a newsletter, a quarterly newsletter. It's jam-packed full of all of the latest news about agriculture, about animal production, and I just really enjoy using it, and we use many of the items here on Animal Voices. Well, Alan Jensen, you've been very quiet here.
Yeah, well, I've just been, when you get into your conversations you do occasionally with Howard, they're so good. I'm just happy to sit back and listen. It was a great interview and just full of information, and you always come up with really good questions for Howard. You guys have great rapport and have good discussions around these issues and really, really valuable stuff. I'm glad that we had lots of time today to hear so much of what Howard said around these issues. He is so well informed, and obviously spends a lot of his time reading and doing research and so on, and brings a lot of information around these issues of you know, so-called scientific experimentation and genetic engineering that we are being subject to. And of course, in Canada, we have the same problems as in the States. The government refuses to properly label genetically modified foods. We have to get out of here, Carl. We've only got 1 minute to go.
1 minute to go?
Or less.
And we'll just say that there is a case against having perfect lawns. And we were so thrilled that Ontario spoke out against lawns by banning cosmetic pesticides. You know, and Howard Lyman in his quarterly thing, he said that by the end of World War II, over 80% of American households were growing some of their own food. So there's a movement happening here in Canada. We're growing our own food, and we're all the better for it. And you've been listening to Animal Voices. Many of our programs are posted on animalvoices.org. And thank you for listening.
It sucks computer waste gets stuck in